Welcome, everyone, to this evening's edition of the Global Math Department. Before I introduce our presenter and we get started, I would like you to introduce yourself in the chat room window. You can type in where you are from, what you teach, and your Twitter handle if you have one.
Statistics and quantitative reasoning, that sounds fun.
All right, I'm guessing we'll have several people join us later. We had many people sign up for this session. If at some point you need to leave the session, don't worry. The session is being recorded, and you can always go back and view this session another time at the Global Math Department website. My name is Lena Taro, and I will be your host this evening. If you have questions, feel free to type them in the chat room window. I will be fielding the questions for our presenter. Our presenter tonight is Zach Strother. Zach is an eighth year science teacher. His teaching career began in West Africa with the United States Peace Corps, working in indigenous schools in Guinea and Burkina Faso. He currently teaches science, and he is a curriculum designer at Mount Vernon Presbyterian School in Atlanta, Georgia. Tonight, he will be talking to us about building meaningful and effective STEM projects. Take it away, Zach.
Thank you very much, Lee, and good evening to all of you that are joining us here on this Tuesday evening. And for those of you watching the recorded webinar after the fact, happy whatever time of day it is right now. I am going to tell you a little bit about some projects that I've worked on in the last couple of years and offer them up as a sort of case study tonight to talk about the process of how I designed them and the people that I worked with as I did that. And before I get started, I'll just tell you a little bit about the structure of the presentation, because I think it will help understand the thought process of designing a good project-based learning experience. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the conditions at the school that I work at and some of the design constraints that we had in mind for our project, you know, sort of understanding the ethos of your working environment and the constraints and the sort of design drivers of your school community is essential. Second, I'm going to talk a little bit about starting points and ending points for the project design experience, you know, and think about that as a framework for connecting the material that comes in between. But identifying that starting point and that ending point as a framework for building out the rest of the project. Third, and lastly, I will give you an overview of some of the interdisciplinary STEM projects that I've implemented with the teachers you see on the slide in front of you over the last 2 years, to offer up some examples of what they can look like. And then there should be plenty of time at the end for questions, because I know a lot of times they're really interesting, specific situations, and it's great to bounce ideas off of other people. So first of all, let me just say that I worked with a great team of teachers at Mount Vernon Presbyterian School, who you see on the slide in front of you. That's me on the far right there. And actually, I didn't plan this, but I am wearing exactly the same shirt that's in the slide, so that's some good mojo. TJ in the center is an engineering teacher. And Robin on the far left was the math teacher on our team. And the year that we first worked together, she was teaching Algebra 2. I was teaching AP Physics, and TJ was teaching an engineering elective course. So a little bit about our school and some of the major design drivers of our project. First of all, we used a method of project design called design thinking that puts a lot of emphasis on identifying an audience and looking at how you can apply your students' skills and your knowledge to improve the quality of life for that user or to solve a specific problem that they might have. So that put a major sort of driving force behind our projects. We knew that we wanted our students to be building or designing for something, for somebody, for an audience, and specifically that process would involve building prototypes and experimenting and revising those prototypes. That's another big part of this design thinking process. Oh, and by the way, you'll notice at the bottom of this slide and on the front page, you may have noticed a bit.ly link. That is a link to a blog entry by my colleague Robin that has these slides, if you'd like to go back and view them outside of the webinar as well, as some downloadable PDFs of these pages like the one you see on this particular slide that are from a free resource my school put together to help teachers build projects, in particular design thinking projects. So check it out. A second major design driver for us is a set of descriptors for good, robust project put out by the Buck Institute for Education. This is a shout out to them. It's a great resource if you're looking for examples of projects or just project management tools. They have a wealth of resources, and they also have a lot of literature about important aspects of strong projects, which they called the gold standard of PBL. You'll see it on this slide in front of you. And it encompasses some of the other things I've already talked about when I referred to design thinking, like having a public product, an audience that you're working towards, you know, focusing on a challenging problem or a question that's particular to that audience. The authenticity piece really comes from the students having actual questions, interacting with individuals in their community. So it gives you a lot of elements that you can incorporate as you think about designing a project. As a side note, I'll just mention that I think one reason a lot of teachers don't do more project-based learning in their classes is because, I mean, when you look at great graphic organizers like this, it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different wedges on it. It's a lot of design components to keep in mind, and it can feel a little overwhelming. I just want to emphasize that project-based learning can happen on multiple scales and doesn't necessarily have to incorporate all of these elements to still be a really valuable teaching tool and learning experience for the students. So you can think about doing smaller scale projects. And as I discuss some of the examples that I've worked on myself, you'll see PBL happening in sort of an iterative way on multiple levels, so smaller scales that build into a bigger scale as well. So keep that in mind. There's options in terms of how big you go when you do your project design. The last thing I'll say about the working conditions, the sort of design drivers for my particular work environment, these are just some of the norms that are advocated at Mount Vernon, particularly the idea of failing up, this idea that trying things and sort of experimenting and figuring out what doesn't work and having an attitude that encourages perseverance is an important part of project work, and in particular STEM-based project work where you're doing a lot of experimenting and collecting data and trying to build models that don't always pan out. So something to keep in mind is I'm sure you have norms and values, a mission statement that's particular to your school or your working environment, and that'll influence what you prioritize as you design your own project. But wherever you are, it's important to understand what your starting point is. So speaking of starting points, that brings me to what is maybe my first true piece of practical advice for the evening. If you want to build a PBL unit, how do you get started? How do you actually begin? And let me just say as another side note, or maybe an interesting commentary, why do PBL at all? You know, some people might ask, maybe not you because you're here in a webinar about how to do good PBLs, but other people might ask you this question. And I think that besides the fact that it's a great way to really get it higher level analytical and application based, synthesis of knowledge. You know, it's just important for everyday life. And I found a great example of this just flipping through the news last week. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the website 538, but they published an article, which I just posted in the chat, about our Supreme Court of the United States. And the title is, "The Supreme Court is Allergic to Math." So just let that sink in a little bit. I'll just briefly summarize what this is about. It's a case that's been referred up to the Supreme Court about gerrymandering, you know, the practice of drawing contrived congressional districts to protect seats. And the case revolves around a group that's devised a mathematical formula to measure the extent of gerrymandering and try to get a quantitative measure of it. And it turned out that this was extremely controversial to a lot of the justices. And I'll just read you a couple of selections of what our justices had to say about it, and then I'll tell you about the math that's involved and let you decide how mind-blowing it is. One justice, and this is from the 538 article, one justice called the math baloney and argued that the difficulty the public would have in understanding the test would ultimately erode the legitimacy of the court. Now, what's interesting about that is it's not only the Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch himself who's concerned about not understanding the math, but he's concerned that the general public is so ignorant of mathematics that they would not comprehend this formula and therefore would perceive the Supreme Court as being biased. Chief Justice John Roberts said, "It may simply be my educational background, but I can only describe it as sociological gobbledygook." Gobbledygook, wow. Yeah, and Chief Justice John Roberts has 2 degrees from Harvard, by the way. So that is his educational background referred to in the quote. So are you ready for this, the formula? It's a formula called an efficiency gap, and here's how it's calculated. For each political party, you take the number of quote-unquote wasted votes, which are votes that go to a losing candidate or excess votes that go to a winning candidate. So you take the number of wasted votes and you divide it by the total number of all votes cast. And that is the wasted vote quotient for each party. And then you just subtract the two to find the difference. And that's the efficiency gap. That is the math that is so mind-blowing that it would erode the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. Algebra. Wow. Gobbledygook. Okay. All right. I won't say any more about that because it just makes me upset. But I think it really does drive home the point that understanding math, and particularly understanding math in a broader context that connects it to the real world and its applications, is important for everybody, whether or not they intend to be a, you know, going into a technical profession or in engineering or science or whatever. I think that math literacy is something which, you know, everyone should be concerned about. You know, that every student should graduate high school with is a level of math literacy that allows them to understand issues around them. So with that in mind, you know, if we want to help with that as teachers, let's talk about starting points. And I'm going to suggest 3 different starting points that you could take as you think about planning a project. So first is the other disciplines or classes. So feel free to shout out in the chat if you have any ideas for natural intersections. But, you know, one way to start about is thinking about the other courses that are offered at the school at which you work or which are likely to be offered at schools if you're training teachers that are going to be at their institutions, and think about the natural overlaps and the standards that are associated with those classes. For instance, in the projects that I've worked on, you know, there are overlaps in some of the learning outcomes or standards for physics and algebra 2 as pertains to manipulating formulas, looking at some elements of trigonometry, and so on. So these were literally, you know, standards that were already being evaluated in both of our classes, but it was a matter of us sort of sitting down and looking at them side to side and thinking about these intentional intersections. Do I ever start with a question that needs to be solved? Absolutely. That is definitely, I think, a great starting point to think about. I'll jump ahead to that in a minute. Starting point number two is thinking about the colleagues that you would be excited to collaborate with. And I'll just tell you a little bit of a story of how we got started. It actually began with Robin, the math teacher of the group, attending the NCTM conference in Boston. I think that was in 2015. And she was struck by the absence of sessions at that particular conference that focused on either project-based learning or design thinking, you know, because it's something that we had talked about casually, just as colleagues, you know, professional collaborators in our time at Mount Vernon together, and, you know, sort of bounced ideas off of each other. And so she sort of walked away from that experience with an idea that, you know, there was a real opportunity to do something that more people should be doing. And then we also knew that TJ was excited about the same thing. So really, these were just connections that happened intrinsically through workplace interaction. You know, maybe I'm lucky to work at a place where I have the opportunity to talk to people about cool stuff like this, but, you know, maybe one way to start, if you don't have a person that immediately jumps to mind, is to bounce ideas off of people. If you have something percolating because you think about an interesting problem, or, you know, you have an idea about a course where there's a good natural intersection of standards. Okay, so that's two starting points, one by looking at a disciplinary intersection, one by looking at strong collaborators. The third starting point is one that Janet already referred to, you know, a problem or a question that you think your students might be excited to sink their teeth into, or that you feel like you have some interesting connections that you could show them. And the reason I mentioned that with this slide is that the first project that we worked on ultimately was spawned by an interesting experience that TJ had on a trip with some students, where they went to this amazing bicycle shop and they disassembled and customized bikes on a per customer basis. And it really got them thinking about how to optimize that particular piece of technology for particular users. And so the reason I suggest three different starting points is not to make things more complicated, but hopefully to make them easier. Because again, as I mentioned before, I think a lot of times people don't get into doing PBL because there's a perceived barrier. You know, it feels like there's a lot of different things that you need to know. But I think if you picked any of these starting points because it felt like low-hanging fruit to you, you'll find that a lot of times the other things intrinsically follow and they sort of build off of each other. That's largely the experience I had as I started working on projects with TJ and Robin. So like Janet mentioned, the idea of starting with a question, if that's something that comes obviously to you, or if you have a question in mind, that's great. That could be the starting point that you build the rest of your project off of. So what do you do when you have that starting point? All right, what's the next step? Where do you go from there? This is another slide from the design thinking playbook that I referred to before that you can get from the bit.ly link. It's called the Adventure Grid, and it's intended to help you brainstorm the experiences or the interactions that might be either the jumping off point or the terminus of your project. So I'll say a couple of things about this particular slide and the thought process when it comes to designing a project. So you have an idea, you have a content area, you have a general vicinity for your project, and then you're asking the question of where do you go from there? Well, it's really, really important to have a starting points, an entry event that engages your students and gets them excited about working on the project. And it's really, really important to have a target in mind at the end, a sort of creative constraint for them as they work on a project, and that gives them something to aim for. And this tool is a great way to speculate about both of those things, right? An entry event that gets them interested in the problem might be, you know, interviewing somebody that works with that problem area. I'll give you a couple of examples of that as I talk about the projects that we've worked on, you know, things they can research, places they can go. I really strongly encourage you, especially if you want to do some kind of large scale project, to spend a good long time thinking about a great entry event for your students to jump into to really get them excited about the experience. And also to think about the public product, the thing that they're going to do at the end with whatever they develop or whatever their final product is, even if it's not necessarily handing that over to a person to use in their everyday life, but getting feedback on their work from an authentic audience outside of the classroom is really another amazing asset of doing this kind of PBL design work that you don't want to miss out on if you're going to go through the trouble of designing a project. So before moving on, I'll make one other comment, which is that based on how large of a scale you might be considering when you think about doing a project, there's a lot of aspects to plan. Take your time. The first experience we had iterating a project like this, we started planning it in February of 2015 in anticipation of doing it in the fall semester of 2016. So 7 to 8 months in advance. And I'm not saying we, you know, spent hours and hours every single week, but we definitely gave ourselves plenty of time to think of ideas and play with the structure and answer all of the logistical questions that were necessary to do a project that spanned multiple weeks and encompassed three different classes. If you're starting smaller, then you can obviously scale that down. But I think either way, especially if you're trying out PBL for the first time, it's important to choose a project that feels manageable to you and not overwhelming in terms of its scope. So let me tell you a little bit about the entry event that TJ experienced personally that got him excited about the project. It was a trip he took with some students to San Francisco. And as I mentioned, they went to this bike shop and talked them through the process of how they bring a client in, and interview them, figure out what they want to use the bike for, talk about their priorities as a cyclist, and then help them as experts sort of piece by piece put their bicycle together. And that was the idea that really enchanted TJ. So he brought that back to us, Robin and I, and that is how the project got started. So as I mentioned before, you can start from many different starting points and they sort of naturally build off of each other. Well, that was our experience. Robin was the one that was excited about doing a project with TJ and I, but she didn't really have an idea of what that project might be. And then TJ was fresh back from San Francisco with this bicycle experience and had this idea about replicating it and applying it in the Atlanta urban context. And I saw the natural intersections between the physics involved in using a bicycle and the mathematics and the engineering. And so, although none of us individually might have connected all of those dots by ourselves, just getting the process started, getting the ball rolling, allowed us to sort of bounce ideas off of each other and eventually build out the concept of the project over time. But of course, I don't want to paint an unrealistically rosy picture. I know there are barriers to implementation. This is definitely something where if you have questions, maybe take a minute or two to think about some of the barriers, some of the things that feel like reasons it would be difficult to do a project in your particular context. And maybe we can archive those to discuss how we might work around some of those towards the end of the session. What barriers come to mind if you think about project implementation? Is there anything that's right on the tip of anybody's tongue? Time is definitely a big one. And time in multiple senses, really. Time in terms of class time, times in terms of coordinating, if you have different classes working together, time to do field trips, costs as well. Yeah, that's a big one too. Yeah, doing that matchmaking process. Yeah, these are great examples. Well, let's talk about time, for instance. And actually, this actually speaks to both time and curriculum. So Robin and TJ and I had a starting point and in some kind of ending point for the bicycle project. I mean, the starting point was obviously looking at and taking apart bicycles and talking to people that used bicycles, figure out what their priorities were for urban biking in the Atlanta area. And then the final exhibition was going to be them making some revised designs and coming back to those bikers and getting their feedback on the improvements that they had pitched. And then we had to figure out what came in between. So what you see on this slide here is our first low-res attempt to answer that question. And it was literally just a process of taking small bites out of the questions that we were trying to answer one piece at a time. So we just started with the things that we knew. We wrote the schedule for the semester out on the board, the weeks we were going to be in class, where were the major holidays, where were we going to miss a lot of class time and wouldn't have the students. And then we filled in the curriculum that we had planned on addressing in the fall semester. You'll see the engineering curriculum in red, the physics in dark blue, and the algebra 2 in lighter colored blue. And then we tried to match it up with where it was going to fall in the semester and think about the intentional overlaps of curriculum. And that was simply our starting point. Even though we didn't know exactly what we were going to do with our classes at those moments of, you know, curricular overlap, we knew they were there, and that was a starting point for us to then think about how to fill in the rest of the gaps. But by starting small and just working with what we knew and working with the variables that we had some control over, it gave us something to build on as we thought about the rest of the process. Okay, so now let's look at, oh, great question, Lee. Are all the students in both classes? The answer to that is a resounding no. Actually, between the three classes, the engineering elective class, the algebra 2 class, and the physics class, the only overlaps were a couple of students that were in the algebra 2 class that were taking the engineering elective and one physics student that was in the engineering elective as well. But there were actually no overlaps between the math and the physics class. So that was something we had to consider as well as we thought about the design of the project and what kind of work the students were going to be doing together. And ultimately, what we settled on was a sort of corporation allegory. Since we knew the students were going to be working on this bike design project, we thought about defining each class's contribution, since they'd be working somewhat separately, since there weren't a lot of overlaps between the classes. The engineering class became the design department, and their job was to sort of pitch ideas for modifications to the bicycle based on interviewing the bicycle riders. And the physics class became the research and development department that would take the ideas generated by the engineering students and try to design procedures to collect data to measure the hypotheses essentially generated by the engineers. And the math students would be accounting and analytics. They would take the data produced by the science classes and build the graphs and solve the algebraic equations that the physics class built for them. So that each class had a unique contribution to make. And in order to facilitate students each having a lot of opportunities to connect to different projects and make ideas, we subdivided so that there were in each class five or six different groups. So there were five or six engineering groups proposing different engineering designs that went to five or six different groups in the physics class that passed data on to five or six different groups in the algebra class. So we sort of had subgroups within each particular class communicating with each other. So let's talk about what the process looked like. Like what was filled in with all of our little squiggles on the board there? Well, here was what it looked like. So we started, and this is an example of what I was mentioning before of collaboration and project-based learning happening on multiple scales. We started with before the engineers even came into the picture, with just the physics and math students doing some small-scale labs. So essentially, the physics students who were going to be doing introductory labs anyway, basic labs on concepts like, you know, Newton's laws and kinematics and so on, I recontextualized those labs in the context of bicycles and, you know, vehicular motion. I included some inquiry-based design elements so that they were getting the basic concepts and also getting a small amount of training in designing and testing independently their own experimental questions. And then Robin and I coordinated, because our classes met during the same period, to have the math classes and the physics classes come together and do the labs together, collect the labs together, collect the data, excuse me, and then the math students would take the data bath with them and work with it independently in their algebra class and send it back to the physics students to, you know, finalize their experimental analysis. And so we were replicating on a smaller scale the larger concept of the project itself. And we were giving the students a little bit of pre-training, if you will, of doing interdisciplinary collaboration. And I'm glad that we did, because doing these small scale iterations, we ended up doing three of these, I think, by the way, before all of the classes came together to really start the project. Each time we learned a little bit about what was necessary for them to collaborate effectively. For instance, after having them work together the first time, we realized we needed to have them communicating with each other several days in advance to discuss the experimental procedure and understand the objectives for the math class before they walk through the door, instead of having to spend a lot of time, you know, when you have very limited collaboration time, just sort of doing the background. And also looking at having the students delegate and getting everybody involved. Sort of, we learned a lot about how to actively facilitate and walk around and ask them questions about what they were working on as we went through multiple iterations. So after the soft introduction was done, all three classes came together. And we had the entry event. In this case, for this project, we did two things. We brought in a panel of active bicycle enthusiasts and let them talk about their experience, and then let the students interview them and ask them questions with the objective of identifying what were the principal challenges or the complaints that they had. What did they wish was different about the bicycles? And then we let the students play with them a little bit. We did what's called a functional decomposition in engineering speak of the bicycle, which you see on the right there. They literally pulled it apart, every single piece, mapped out how they were connected, and figured out what the particular function was of each part of the bicycle to sort of understand what they were starting with and how the device was put together in the first place. Sort of like if you were ever a kid and you took something apart to figure out how it worked. We put the students through that process and they really enjoyed it. And you got this cool STEM-looking art project kind of out of it too. You know, if you want to stick that out in the hallway and get the rest of your school community excited about exciting PBL-based interdisciplinary work that you're doing. And on the basis of these interviews, the groups of engineering students started to produce ideas. There were ideas about modifying the location of the shocks in the bicycle to put them on top of the central rod of the bicycle under the seat. There are ideas about modifying the gear ratios that affected the steering. There are ideas about modifying the treads on the tires. And so as these engineering groups produced hypotheses, wrote them up in documents, we also taught the students a little about creating scientific documents for technical communication. Another great ancillary benefit, by the way, of doing STEM PBL is I think that it offers a lot of really great opportunities to work on effective communication of technical and mathematical concepts, right? Sort of connecting back to this idea of mathematical literacy is being able to articulate and apply mathematical ideas, talk about them with your peers in order to work together towards a common goal goes a long way towards preparing them to deal with mathematical arguments and questions that they encounter in everyday life. So, hypotheses produced. They sent those on over to the physics and math class to design experiments. These are some really fun pictures I really enjoy. You see some students here testing modifications to the tread, measuring new coefficients of friction based on some recommendations from the engineering class. And did they collect amazing data? I think they could have made some improvements. You know, I don't know if it would have been, you know, publishable quality, but it really inspired them to do some innovative design and think about how to collect the kind of data that they would need to improve the quality of the work. And another way that it improved their technical quantitative communication skills is, in many cases, they needed to go back to the engineering students and have conversations to understand exactly what it was that the engineering students were trying to improve it and what they would need to measure in order to figure out whether these ideas would work or not. And another comment, and this speaks to the idea of scale in terms of how big your PBL is and how much time you wanted to dedicate to it. Another great element to incorporate is the idea of iterating the prototypes. For instance, we had initially conceptualized this project as involving multiple cycles so that the students in the math and physics classes would produce data-driven feedback on the engineering designs that then would inform a redesign or modification based on the data that was collected that could then be tested once again. It turned out that for us, that was biting off more than we could chew and we had to scale it back, but it's something that I'd love to revisit in the future. Here's one more example of a student design prototype dealing with the effects of gear ratios. And it's a little bit silly, but I just love showing it to people because it's sort of mind blowing. Hopefully you can make out the details there, but you'll see that they built a system of gears out of styrofoam plates and string and pencils that they've strung up on lab benches. And they've got a mass and pulley system on the right-hand side. And they're testing the rate of descent to figure out the resistance produced by varying the gear ratios there. Another example of a project, so this was our first year iteration. The second year iteration, we decided to focus on assistive technology for things, which encompasses everything from wheelchairs to visual aids to grip enhancements and things like that for people with musculoskeletal disorders, muscular dystrophy, and so on, a really broad swath of different technology. But we thought that that was a great angle for both, you know, its obvious connections to mechanics and engineering, which again gave us the connections to algebra, but also the empathy piece of being able to really identify a user and think about what their needs were to drive the elements of the design, get the students excited and engaged about working on the projects. And for that project, our entry invent involved coordinating with a group in Atlanta out of Georgia Tech that does laboratory design for assistive technology, and we were able to connect with them remotely and allow the students to pilot a robot through their laboratory, which, you know, is that a direct math lesson or science lesson, engineering lesson? No, but it's something that makes them excited to work on the content of the project. It helps them contextualize why this kind of work is important and see the applications. And ultimately, it produced a really inspiring batch of products, including some students that 3D printed and optimized gripper for people with weak hand grip and musculoskeletal disorders, based on an application of torque physics and working with some algebraic equations. So I'll wrap it up by talking about what were the biggest wins that each of the primary instructional designers took away from these experiences that we've iterated over the last couple of years. For TJ, it was really an understanding of the importance of the entry events and the closing events for both the impact they had on the students and for the role they play in structuring the project and keeping the students engaged. You know, we learned that first year because we had a well-designed entry event, but we failed to follow through on arranging a strong closing point to the project. We weren't able to bring the bikers back in to have the students present their designs to them. And that was, didn't make the project a failure, but it definitely taught us how important it was to incorporate and emphasize that element in the following year. For my part as a science teacher, I'll say that what I've appreciated the most about working on these kind of projects is that it gets the students thinking in a really deep way about the nature of science, which in the same way that mathematical literacy is an important issue in the modern world, I think scientific literacy is just as important in its own way. And I think that doing active experimental design that's driven by the students' inquiry they see in response to a real problem, or, you know, the concern of a real person that they've talked to, goes a long way towards helping them understand or get excited about working in this kind of content. And for Robin, who is the Algebra 2 teacher who was part of this project, she said the biggest win was getting to see a lot more of those aha moments. It was her experience that when the students had a direct visual reference for the math that they were working with, you know, sitting there with the physics students, they're literally seeing the equations play out in front of them and going back and manipulating the numbers and pulling meaningful information out of that. For a lot of students, that was the thing that allowed the light bulb to click. That was really something that made math feel a little bit less like this arduous, repetitious process, and something that has predictive power that helps you understand and measure the world. So I think that, you know, it sort of brings me back to my starting point of why should we be doing this kind of work in the first place? What is its value? And I think it's exactly that. It speaks to raising the level of scientific and mathematical literacy across the board for all students that are exposed to it. And for some students, it will be the experience that really drives them to become more active and engaged in these fields that might persuade them to pursue a scientific or mathematical major when otherwise they might not have. So that's all I'll say about that. Thank you for joining me this evening. With the time that we have left, I'd love to take any questions or discuss any things that y'all wanted to hear a little bit more about.
Well, thank you very much for doing the presentation this evening, Zach. There wasn't a lot of questions that came up in the chat room window.
Sure.
But I mean, I'm thinking about this myself because we're in my school, we formed a book group around one of the project-based learning books the one that's setting the standard for project-based learning. And
Yes,
so,
yes.
you know, part of it is having, as you said, the time to kind of figure out what you're doing, like the fact that you've planned it out so much in advance. How did that work in your particular situation? Like, did you have time in the summer? Did you like have a common planning time with the other teachers? Like, how did that work out in your particular situation?
Great question. Well, for us, we had some, we had one common planning period that was really helpful, but a lot of the work, to be honest, was done during, you know, after school conversations or professional development days. For instance, you know, my school has a couple of days over the course of the year where we have half days of professional development and the other half of the day is a holiday. We would be there for an extra hour or two, you know, fleshing some of this out. And we did also work together over the summer. We got together a few different times to nail down particular aspects of the design. In the first summer that we did this, the summer before the bicycle project, we were very fortunate to receive a stipend, essentially a professional development grant to work on developing it as a model project for our work over the summer. But the second year, we didn't. We just still decided to get together over the summer because we were excited to do the projects. So excited enough to give up a few days here and there to firm up all of the details. Another thing I'll say as far as time goes, especially in the early design portion of getting ready for a project, is that a lot of the time, our experience was that we would get together and have really intense conversations where we would bounce a lot of ideas off of each other and walk away with something feeling like a firm plan. And then it would marinate for a while and we'd think about what we needed to revisit or what we needed to work on more. And we sort of had this cycle of working together intensely for a few hours at a time and then independently fleshing out other aspects of the project and doing also some asynchronous communication, you know, via email and Google Docs are great resources. If you're comfortable using Google Docs to collaborate with each other, I recommend it. If I was gonna, all right, so Janet says, did the three teachers grade the final projects? Great question. And also grading at other various points. Yes. So if you recall from the discussion of the structure, there were iterations before the whole project even began where the math and science students were working together independently. And so I graded each one of those experiences as a lab, and so did Robin, the math teacher. One thing I'll say about that, which is quite important in my view, is that even though they might have been working together on the same product, they had individual contributions that were particular to what, you know, they were expected to contribute to the project. So there were, you know, math specific learning outcomes that were being addressed by the elements of the experience that Robin's students were participating in. And the same is true for the science students. And what I mean by that is, you know, even though they produced a lab report, for instance, during those earlier collaborations, the math students made different contributions to that process than the science students did. And the math students even had a sort of a separate component that they turned into Robin that I didn't see at all. My point being that it's possible for the students to work on a common product, but be assessed separately. It's a form of differentiation of the experience, which is appropriate, I think, when you're doing interdisciplinary collaboration, if the intention was, as it was in this case, for each of them to be making discipline-specific contributions to the product. And of course, you should always have, you know, a formative assessment cycle built in to any project, or I mean any work at all, really. So that happens on multiple scales, whether it's just, you know, your interactions with the students while they're working or in between they're finishing the lab work and finalizing the lab report and so on. If I was going to get my feet wet with this, what suggestions would I have? I mean, obviously start small. I think that the easiest way to get started is, you know, if you find one standard, one area of overlap with one other class and can plan some kind of one-off activity with the teacher of that other class. So in the same way that Robin and I did physics labs that also spoke to certain Algebra 2 skills, you know, the students were able to come together and work on that together and take away something from it independently. And if there had never been a bicycle project, they still would have been able to have that self-contained experience. So I think a good way to get started is by just looking for one small point of overlap in the standards. And if you're looking for the easiest areas of overlap, right, typically to start with the science classes, or Lee mentioned economics. I think there's a lot of data-based things you can do with the social sciences for sure, if you're thinking about a statistics course, for instance. How did AP Physics cover all content needed for the exam while doing this project? Great question. Super common concern, right, is doing this kind of work, which a lot of time can be ambiguous in terms of time frame, with the rigorous demands that the AP curriculum is holding you to. And I can tell you, I was absolutely concerned about that myself going into it the first time. And I had a crazy experience, actually, which is that somehow, some way, and I can't quite add up all the numbers and figure it out, I ended up ahead of schedule this year that I did the bicycle project. We actually ended up with an extra week, essentially, of time to do the AP prep that I do in the springtime when they're getting ready for the exam. I think it's easy to underestimate, for the AP physics course in particular, how important it is to really have robust experimental design skills and conceptualization, and think about how to connect equations into measurable, identifiable concepts. You know, so it's almost for me was an experience of front loading them in the course. We did this project spread out over the course of the first semester, you know, beginning in September and winding down towards the end of October, early November. And it was such a rigorous experience for them, but it really left them with a very strong sense of experimental design and a way of thinking about equations that was much less, you know, contrived and algorithmic and much more conceptually grounded. And in that way made the rest of the class experience more efficient. Now, I can't claim that that would happen in every single AP class for sure. I think that some of the AP courses probably lend themselves a little bit better to PBL type collaboration than other classes do. Like, I think that AP physics and AP environmental science, for instance, probably lend themselves a little bit better to this kind of collaboration than an AP bio, you know, or an AP human anatomy or something like that. But yeah, AP statistics, I bet you could figure out how to make that work, right? But I think in my mind, that sort of goes into the idea I talked about at the beginning of constraints. You know, there are probably 100 like super amazing projects that we could all wish we could do. And, you know, while we're living in the real world, we sort of have to work with the art of the possible, which means sort of living with the school that you're in and doing the best with you can, you know, with the low hanging fruit that's in front of you, and thinking about using that as a way to build to bigger and more ambitious project-based endeavors. Oh, and not that anybody asked this question in particular, but I think it's worth mentioning as concerns project-based learning. It's an amazing pedagogical tool to incorporate elements of inquiry and to do, you know, mathematical and scientific process, and to do higher level applications and synthesis. But there's a good bit of educational research, some meta studies done by Hattie, if you're familiar with his work, that show PBL is really not very great as a way of learning the foundational concepts to introduce them, you know, sort of in a vacuum or without context, you know. So that's something to think about as well, as students tend to succeed much more when they have the basic tools that you're asking them to do the project with. You know, they sort of, they have to know what kinds of questions they have the ability to answer before they start dashing out on their own. That's another way that you can avoid unproductive lines of inquiry, which is one danger that you may encounter if you are really ambitious and you dive into a totally open-ended PBL experience. You know, I think a lot of good teachers respect the idea of understanding by design. As you think about building your units, you have an idea of what you want your students to learn, and you work backwards from there to design the experiences that are going to give them the concepts and skills to learn the things you know they need to learn. But when you do design thinking and inquiry-based instruction, you leave some elements open to them. And so you play this game of finding the right combination of constraints and foundational experiences that will point them in the direction you want them to go, but still give them some room to flex their creative muscles and maybe surprise you with some of the interesting connections that they'll find.
Thank you very much tonight for sharing that information with us, Zach. I know it made me think about some things a little differently in terms of what's possible.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed speaking with you all tonight.
All right, I will be turning off the recording now. If there are any other questions for Zach, feel free to type them in the chat room. This recording will be available on the Global Math Department website. I think it's usually within 24 hours, maybe less. Have a wonderful evening, everyone.
Good night.